Hello, this is Background Briefing. Today, not with Ian Masters, who's on a well-earned vacation. I'm Tom Lutz. I teach at UC Riverside, and I'm the editor of the Los Angeles Review of Books. This is my second time guest hosting for Ian Masters, which makes me feel a little bit like Joey Bishop. It also makes me wonder how old you have to be to get that joke. My guest today is Tom Hayden, to whom this show's listeners need no introduction, but you're going to get one anyway. We'll be joined over the course of the hour by three of my contributors and editors at the LA Review of Books, Seth Greenland, Don Franzen, and Ruben Martinez. Tom Hayden is the director of the Peace and Justice Resource Center in Culver City. He's the author of 19 books and hundreds of articles in books, journals, newspapers, and magazines, although perhaps no single one of them launched quite as many ships as the 1962 Port Huron Statement, the call to arms of the Students for a Democratic Society, which he helped found. Tom spent 10 years in the California State Assembly and 8 in the State Senate, and has been at the forefront of dozens of progressive, democratic, and environmental movements over the last 5 decades. Welcome, Tom.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. I think what I'd like to do is start with war. And first, I'd like to thank you for keeping me out of Vietnam. by the time my draft number came up, troops were coming home.
You don't owe me anything.
But it was in no small measure because of the anti-war activism of you and your colleagues. At the top of your agenda for the last 50 years has always been, put most broadly, human rights, justice, and your anti-war activities from Vietnam to Afghanistan are part of that. Over those nearly 50 years, the military, industrial, financial, political complex has become even stronger, it seems. Operational spending on Iraq and Afghanistan dwarfs the total outlay for Vietnam. The cost of Iraq alone in adjusted dollars surpassed Vietnam back in 2009. Are we ever going to make some headway?
Well, it's a good question. On the one hand, doesn't appear that we'll ever make any headway, but of course, that's not true. The war in Iraq is over, for example. It's kind of a obligation to see progress in a context of regress. Mm. And it's hard to know the balance. It's really very difficult.
Your most recent book is on Afghanistan, and we are we're winding down there. Winding down fast enough?
It's not as rapid a retreat as some of us would desire. I myself actually, I supported Barack Obama for president while opposing his plan for Afghanistan, and that was almost 5 years ago. And finally, we're getting out in terms of combat troops, leaving the country devastated. There will be a political squabble over residual forces and bases. I'm not sure that'll go well for anyone concerned. Look at the end of Iraq, which was supposed to be this necessary endeavor. Now we have, in this morning's papers, Iraq is servicing the shipment of weapons by Iranian planes. So we spent all that life and fortune on Iraq and wound up with a pro-Iranian government. So I don't think that there's necessarily a happy ending on the horizon for Afghanistan, but there's an ending.
And is there anything that can be done to make it a happier ending? That is, anything that people should be working on here?
There are some people in the peace movement who would be very, very concerned about humanitarian assistance to compensate for damage done. There would be people very concerned about preservation of very fragile rights of women to schooling and participation that have been eked out in an extremely male authoritarian society. Mm-hmm. what leverage the United States government has, what leverage specifically Hillary Clinton has, remains to be seen. But I suppose as a condition for ultimately getting everything else out, there could be some agreement about preserving those small gains and rights. But it's an ugly picture.
You mentioned Hillary Clinton. She's on her way out of this job, presumably Susan Rice is on her way in. The kind of Republican sideshow about it aside, is this a good thing for the administration?
Well, I mentioned Hillary Clinton because she's worked hard on women's agendas, women's issues. Mm-hmm. In foreign policy, unlike previous secretaries, and she's the presumptive candidate for president next time. She has an interest in women's rights in Afghanistan. She is quite hawkish. She was more hawkish than Barack Obama in 2008. I think Susan Rice is in that model. Susan Rice is quite hawkish, one of these people that, is labeled a humanitarian hawk. On the other hand, extremely competent, and Obama is entitled to appoint who he wants as Secretary of State, and I think what the Republicans are doing is ridiculous. They're trying to get John Kerry, of all people, to be the Secretary of State so they can run Scott Brown for Senate seat. And everybody knows it in Massachusetts, and I think as it dawns on people, it'll backfire on them. They're still fighting the election.
Yeah, somewhat inexplicable. And
I think it's a hangover. It's a aftershock. It's hard to recover from what everybody went through for the past year or two.
To kind of switch gears a little bit, you've also been active in the cause of environmental justice. Yesterday, we were talking briefly about the infrastructure rebuild on the East Coast and the possibility that climate change, which of course is a factor in the severity of the storm, might also be important to the way that the infrastructure is rebuilt. That's obviously your hope. Is it a possibility?
I think that's true. I think you also politically add Bloomberg and Governor Christie to the vocal advocates, along with Governor Cuomo, for green infrastructure, rebuilding, whatever you want to call it. The Obama budget package has $50 billion for new infrastructure, and I think the cost of New Jersey and New York alone will be $150 billion in direct costs. And I don't know where that money will come from, but it adds great clout to the argument that we have to protect ourselves against the extreme weather, which is a reflection of the changing climate. And the environmental movement, I think, stands to make great gains if they can fight district by district for the complete redoing of our environmental standards, not only in automobiles, which the president has done, but in all building construction and in the priority of weatherization and insulation and storm protection, all defensive measures, infrastructure measures, kind of things that employs a lot of building trade workers, and at the same time in green jobs and a huge down payment on the overdue bill. So I think it's very important, and I would hope and pray that Obama stresses climate change in his State of the Union.
And do you think that this is going to include, for instance, more mass transit rather than highway rebuilds and that kind of thing, or is it will it affect policy that far down the road?
I think Jerry Brown wants to be the vanguard on that subject on the national scene. I suspect the way politics works, there'll be an advance for mass transit, a lot of emphasis on new technologies rather than just trains, but there'll be plenty of highway money for you might ask our man downtown here, Antonio Villaraigosa. I think he could have a lot to say about transit policy.
In terms of the East Coast rebuild, did anything like that happen in the rebuild on the Gulf Coast? That is, were these kind of environmental standards at work there?
I think there was some progress. They were caught with a problem that they'd created, but almost insoluble, and that was that they had destroyed the wetlands to such a degree on the New Orleans coast that it made that flooding all the more likely. And the same is true with the East Coast, the Jersey Coast and New York. And people that want to get rid of Wall Street may have their way just by flooding sometime in the next 10 or 15 years. So the rebuilding will have to be... I think some kind of retreat. I can't imagine them bailing out the coastlines the way they were, but the coastlines are now so vulnerable that the rebuilding is going to have to be on higher ground, so to speak.
Mm. You know, we were already talking about the environmental disaster of our taste for fossil fuels back in the 60s. I was one of the hippies cutting my firewood.
I know with
handsaws to save on the chainsaw gas. One of your more recent books is "The Long '60s" from 1960 to Barack Obama, and I guess as that comment implies, and my earlier one about the continuation of the military-industrial complex. Sometimes I look around for vestiges of the idealistic 60s and that helped form me. And sometimes I've had a hard time finding them. Your book suggests that the effects of the 60s have been more lasting and profound than it sometimes seems.
Oh, I think far more, which is not to, stand on that claim and be content. But, there's people that would have us forget the 60s altogether. I think the process of social change is what we want to talk about. There were dozens of very specific gains from the 1960s, but they came as a result of mass movements and uprisings, but they came in disguise often, and people forget as a result of the disguise. Just to give you an example, you had the Earth Day. There were 20 million people in 1970, seemingly out of nowhere, and the passage of very far-reaching environmental worker safety legislation, all signed by Richard Nixon. So people don't go around saying Nixon was a hero of the 60s, but it turned out that... the 60s produced legislation which he, as a Machiavellian politician, found in his interest to sign.
Yeah, let's talk a bit about the process of social change. I want to bring in Seth Greenland to join us. He's a novelist, playwright, screenwriter, and a contributing editor to the Los Angeles Review of Books. His most recent novel, set in Palm Desert, is The Angry Buddhist, and it has an electoral campaign in the center of its action. His most recent screenwriting and producing credits are on Big Love. And in both of those narratives, he's interested in the possibility and improbability of ethical political dealing. We were talking yesterday, Seth. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We were talking about the waning of political activism among young people.
Well, yeah, I'd love to get Tom's thoughts on this because, for 50 years, you've been at the forefront of remarkably effective social action. You know, you contributed hugely to the end of the war in Vietnam. And in many ways, what we're facing environmentally today is much more dangerous than what we were facing when we were fighting in Southeast Asia. And it seems that with the exception of certain pockets of the younger generation, they don't sense the danger, or at least they're not manifesting it behaviorally in what they're facing, because we'll all be dead when the environmental apocalypse happens, but I'm concerned that my children, who are college age, won't be. And yet they seem quiescent in the face of this, and I'd love to get Tom's thoughts on, you know, what can be done to light a fire under that generation, since you've done that before.
I haven't read The Angry Buddhist, but it's on my desk, Seth.
Oh, thank you very much.
Are you sounding like an angry Buddhist now?
No, I'm not angry today, or nor am I Buddhist.
I visited a Buddhist temple to talk to a wise man in Japan many years ago to ask him this question of, like, how would somebody with a religious mission, in this case Buddhism, face the environmental crisis. And after making me a cup of tea, the monk said two things that I'll never forget. One was, the world is ending. The earth is ending. The earth is dying.
Did he mean that week? Or was he thinking more?
Secondly, he said, therefore, compassion arises. So, no, he didn't mean that week. He meant, as a matter of fact, in geological time, all things pass, including even the earth. And in perceiving this, in understanding the suffering and the decline of things, we're left with compassion as a reason for action. That's what he said. He didn't have a concept of making progress, you know, in the Western sense, the
right.
Kind of thing that I would believe in. But he was motivated by this understanding that we're all dying and that we should therefore embrace compassion. So I think there are ways to approach the crisis that you're speaking of, and I agree with you. It, in a sense, it's worse than nuclear weapons, which is what we faced in the past and still do, but we thought the world would end in a nuclear blast. It may, but we've learned how to manage nuclear weapons, however precariously, and yet we don't have any way to manage global warming, the melting of the ice caps, the severe storms, the warming of the seas, all that. No way. And so it can be so overwhelming that I think it makes people retreat. And I think that you know, the way to go forward is out of compassion, and the environmental movement needs to wed compassion with some good strategic thinking about how to achieve what we can within the capacity that's available. I think that the movement associated with Bill McKibben that put a ring around the White House last year and was recently here at UCLA caravanning to D.C. to demand, a radical reduction in warming, has tapped into an idealistic sentiment among young people that combines direct action, civil disobedience, lobbying pressure. And is it enough? Well, we'll see. I think that it's possible that in an ecological sense, we could make an adjustment, an adaptation, as a species adaptation at the last moment. Call it green jobs in the secular world, but it will take a leap of that kind.
I would love to see this coming from a youthful direction. I feel like, to look at it from our perspective, you alluded to something before when you said it's almost overwhelming. I mean, when you really think about what's going on and you look at it internationally and the fact that it's not just our country, of course, it's India, it's China. These are agrarian economies being yanked very, very quickly into the 21st century with massive unprecedented industrialization in terms of the speed at which it's happening. So there's that, and I feel when we look at it, we think, oh God, and you just want to take a Valium and lie down. But kids, college kids in their 20s, the same group that really ended the war in Vietnam. What upsets me is that they're not at the forefront of this, and I wonder what's going on with that. What are they not seeing? Did they not see what occurred in New York a month ago?
Well, it's my perception that to the extent anybody's in the forefront of this, it's young people, it's students, in the 350 movement around the country.
But doesn't it feel marginal compared to what was going on in Vietnam, which became very mainstream pretty quickly?
I would be careful to make those comparisons. I don't know how to compare decades, but I would say no, it's not marginal compared to. Here's my own view is that the environmental movement developed very, very rapidly, and in the course of social movements should have come to power with the election of Al Gore a decade ago, years ago.
That's true.
And then we would see how far an environmental president could reform our environmental ways. That was a loss. That was a staggering loss. That brought about a Bush-Cheney government with Cheney and the oil companies, the war in Iraq, and retrograde changes in the Supreme Court, and it was a disaster. So I think that's equivalent, although Gore's alive and well, that's equivalent to what happened to us with the murders of national leaders in the 60s.
That's a terrific point, actually. The tectonic plates of history were in place for that to occur. You're right. That's,
yeah.
I hadn't looked at it that way, and I think that's very accurate. So perhaps I'm coming down too hard on the college kids of today, I suppose.
Your next book, you might want to write a tragedy.
It's so easy, though.
On this note, let us stop for just 1 minute for a station break.